Yesterday evening, I went through the meaning of the word tabernacles, and at least some of the meaning of the word tabernacles, and pointed out that really it is. It's a temporary dwelling. It's a temporary time that we're in now, presently. Beautiful weather we've got now, isn't it? It means we have to actually close the curtains behind us, just so everybody over on the internet. We're actually having to close the curtains behind us. The sun is streaming in now. It was actually raining this morning. But this is only temporary. I can guarantee this is only temporary. If you've been in England or in the UK for very long, this is a temporary condition. It's the same as this present life. It's only temporary. And it's here for a little while. The tribulation, as I pointed out last night, was only temporary. It's only something that's going to happen for a short time. Even the millennium itself is a temporary thing. It's 1,000 years, and then it goes on into eternity after that. And I pointed out about prayer, our relationship with God, and how important that is. I hope all of us are trying to make sure that we do get that, you know, get on our knees during this festival time, that if we can, spend extra time if we can in prayer, so that we can in fact have this relationship with God the Father. And fellowship with each other. We certainly enjoyed that a great deal over lunch. I hope everybody did down in Nigeria as well, and over in the U.S. that are listening to me. Turn over to Romans chapter 16. Romans chapter 16. I was reading this the other day, and I think it fits in quite well. It's an area of the Bible we never really read very much, partly because we can't really pronounce some of these names that are being mentioned here, over in Romans chapter 16. Verse 11. It says, "Salute Herodian, my kinsman. Greet them that are of the household of our Narcissus, which are in the Lord. Salute, Tryphena, and Tryphosa." Where do you come across these words, these names? Tryphena and Tryphosa. Have you heard of Tryphena and Tryphosa? Well, the chances are you might meet them one day. One day, you might be sitting down at a meal, perhaps in the world tomorrow, and hello, what's your name? Oh, my name's Tryphena. Oh, Tryphena and Tryphosa. How did you know my name? But, you know, it's something we never really even dream about. We never even go through this particular area. We kind of rush over it. But these are individuals. These are people who labor in the Lord. Salute the beloved Perseus, which is labored much in the Lord. Salute Rufus, chosen in the Lord, his mother and mine. Salute, and on it goes through the various ones we can't pronounce. But really, in this particular section, these are all real people. Now, what did they do for a living? Doesn't say. What kind of house did they live in? What kind of life did they have? You know, we don't know very much about them at all, but what we do know is that they are, in fact, in the Lord. They are, in fact, part of the very church. They are people that we're very likely to actually bump into and be dealing with and be ruling in the kingdom of God with at that time. So, as I said last night, I said prayer, fellowship, these are things that are so very, very important. Because the people that we are with here now, if we continue in the faith, if we hold fast right the way through, the relationships that we have will continue into the future, throughout eternity. It's something that will continue. Our job that we engage in, the money we make, our houses, all the other physical things that we've got, that's all going to go by the wayside. But the various relationships that we have and we've developed in this life, within the church specifically, and even outside of the church, the level that we can, we can't do it to much degree, but nevertheless, we know that those are going to continue. Turn over to Isaiah 51. Isaiah 51. This really is a kind of a recap in some ways on what I discussed last night. But Isaiah chapter 51, I read some of this. Did I read this? No, I don't think I did so much. But notice what it actually says here. In Isaiah 51, in verse 1, it says, "Listen to me." Listen to me. This is God speaking. God speaking through the prophet Isaiah to his church. He says, "Listen to me, you that follow after righteousness, you that seek the eternal, look to the rock from where you are hewn, and to the hole of the pit where you are dug. Look to Abraham, your father, and to Sarah that bare you, For I called him alone, and I blessed him and increased him. You know, these people, Abraham and Sarah presumably as well, will be in the world tomorrow. Certainly Abraham will be. But he says, for the eternal shall comfort Zion. And Zion, so often in Isaiah particularly, is referring to the church. He will comfort all her waste places, for he will make her wilderness like Eden, her desert like the garden of the eternal. Joy and gladness shall be found therein, thanksgiving and the voice of melody. I want you to notice how physical this is. It's going to be like Eden. And you're looking at a time of great abundance, you're looking at a time of great joy, and you're looking at a time where the actual wilderness, whatever the wilderness may be, the dwelling place of Zion is going to be like Eden. It's going to be, have a great deal of beauty. It says, listen to me, my people, give ear to me, my nation, for a law will proceed from me, and I will make my judgment to rest for a light of the people. My righteousness is near, my salvation is gone forth, and my arms shall judge the people. The isles shall wait upon me, and on my arm shall they trust. Lift up your eyes to the heavens and look upon the earth beneath, for the heavens will vanish away. Notice what it's saying here. Here are the physical things. The heavens will vanish away like smoke. The earth shall wax old like a garment, and those that dwell therein will die in like manner. But my rescue, my salvation shall be forever. My righteousness shall not be abolished. It's not going to fade. So we're looking at something which is permanent. We're looking at a time, we're looking at certain, you know, spiritual things that are permanent. Listen to me, you that know righteousness, the people in whose heart is my law. Don't fear the reproach of men. Don't be afraid of their revilings. He's talking almost directly to us. You know, so much of the book of Isaiah is actually talking directly to the church. And this is one of these places. He's saying directly to us. He's saying, look, don't worry about men. The moth will eat them up like a garment. The worm will eat them like wool. You know, we've seen moths. We've seen the worm and being used as far as eating wool or whatever, and how a garment falls to pieces. And we don't necessarily see a body decaying, but we can imagine, we can imagine it, and that's what happens to human beings. You know, the actual, the only physical bit is going to go, we're going to disappear. And it says, but my righteousness is going to be forever, my salvation from generation to generation. So awake, put on strength, the arm of the eternal, awake as in ancient days, in the generations of old. Aren't you he, aren't you it that should cut Rahab, that's the Egypt, and wounded the dragon? The dragon of old, the devil, the serpent, and Satan. Are you not it that ride the sea, the waters of the great deep, that have made the depths of the sea a way for the ransom to pass over? Therefore the redeemed of the eternal shall return, and will come with singing to Zion, and everlasting joy will be on their head. They will obtain gladness and joy, sorrow and mourning will flee away. I, even I, am he that comforts you. And who are you that you should be afraid of a man that will die and of the Son of Man which will be made of grass? And you forget the eternal your Maker that has stretched forth the heavens, laid the foundations of the earth, and instead you've been fearing continually. And so he goes through this entire section re-emphasizing and emphasizing the fact that these physical human beings, physical things that you're worried about, that you're concerned about, that all of us get concerned about, are not the, is not the criteria. You know, we need to look beyond that. And it says that every day, because of the fury of the oppressor, as it were, ready to destroy. And where's the fury of the oppressor? The captive exile hastens that he may be loosed, he that should not die in the pit, or his bread shouldn't fail. But I am the eternal, your God, that divided the sea, whose waves roared. The eternal of hosts is his name. And I have put my words in your mouth, and I've covered you with the shadow of my hand. Now, this is very clearly the church. There's nobody else that this is applying it to. It's got to be the church. Because it says, that I may plant the heavens. The heavens themselves have been made, they've been created for a reason and purpose. You know, I've done all this. He says, I've done all of this. I've done allowed all this to take place, that I may plant the heavens and lay the foundations of the earth and say to Zion, you are my people. So he's going to plant the heavens. That's way, way on into the future. Planting the heavens. That's the ultimate goal is we're looking at right out into the future. A new heavens and a new earth. We'll be involved with actually planting these new heavens and new earth. The new heavens, rather. And lay the foundations of the earth. That is very much during the millennium. The foundation of the earth, and then presumably after the millennium, when the new earth is going to be there. Whatever this new earth is, however it's going to be constructed or changed into, whatever this earth is going to change across into, because it's not going to be physical as we know it. It'll be something probably similar, but it doesn't appear to be physical as we know it, because physical things are temporary, but those that are unseen are eternal, as it brings out. But it says, and lay the foundations of the earth, and say to Zion, that's the church, you are my people. Now that's part of our job right now, to make sure that we're keeping that job right now. But you know, as I brought out here in verse 3, where it talks about Eden, and so many other places within Isaiah particularly, you will find that the physical is being mentioned a great deal. Now if we're going to be looking into the future, if all these things that it's saying here are true, and all this physical, because it talks about how the heavens are going to vanish away, and the earth in like manner, wax old like a garment. There's going to at least be fire all over this earth. At least. It may be even more of a destruction than that. But whatever it might be, it is going to be destroyed. Whatever we happen to place, and whatever we make in the millennium, is going to disappear. So why make it? Why on earth go to all the trouble of getting this world sorted out physically? Why go to the trouble and effort and energy to do that and yet have it destroyed? And you know, there's something that I've noticed, and that is that having been to Ambassador College, having seen the way that Mr. Armstrong did work, the way that he actually operated, because I used to be at Ambassador College, and we used to read these prophecies. We thought that the actual time frame was much shorter than it is now. And I could not understand why Mr. Armstrong spent so much money and so much effort and so much time in preparing the college grounds, the college buildings, and everything else. Why not put all the money into the work? Why not go ahead and do these things that were more important? Why put all this money into the grounds and the physical surroundings? Why do that? And it's the same reason, really, as it is here. Exactly the same reason was done, as far as the college is concerned, as to what we find in this book here and this particular section that's talking about the millennium. So that's really the question I want to ask today. Is, you know, if it's going to be destroyed, if all this physical world, even in the millennium, is going to be destroyed, why the physical utopia? Why is it going to be there? You know, the meaning of this day, yes, it's tied into tabernacles, but there's more to it. There's more to the Feast of Tabernacles and the things that we're enacting right now. And there's certain things we need to learn. First of all is that the physical teaches the spiritual. The physical things do teach spiritual lessons in so many, many cases. We're going to go through and have a look at the fact that tabernacles, in fact, is based around the harvest time in Israel. And the harvest, there are two harvests. One is the early harvest, the one is the late harvest. Tabernacles is the latter harvest. And it's part of a much, much bigger plan. It's not just harvest. The whole thing has to fit within a much bigger plan. As has been brought out, I think, this morning, you're looking at the millennium beginning in absolute chaos. The millennial rule will start, and the world will be totally chaotic. It'll be in an incredibly devastated state. But you know, when you come towards the end of the millennium, you're going to see, or during the millennium itself, the scriptures very plainly show an abundance and wealth of a scale that we've never really even anticipated, that we've never really seen today. It's a totally different kind of wealth, a different kind of society as well. So we need to ask that question, why? Why go ahead to all that trouble if this physical is going to be destroyed, or at least, at the very least, changed? So let's have a look at the physical teaching the spiritual. Let's turn over to John chapter 7. John chapter 7. In John chapter 7, we find Christ, on the last day of the feast, he's looking at the last great day, and we'll be reading this particular scripture on the last great day. But he says in verse 53, Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, unless... I've gone on the wrong one. Chapter 7, verse 37. Beg your pardon. John 7, verse 37. In the last great day, that great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried, saying, if any man thirst, let him come to me and drink. Now here is a physical thing that we've been given to understand something which is spiritual. He that believes on me, as the scripture has said, out of his belly will flow rivers of living water. Now living water is kind of water you get out of a spring. You ever seen, you know what a spring's like, obviously. You can go to a well or something like that, and undoubtedly there'll be a spring down the bottom of the well. But you come to a spring at the side of a hillside. In fact, as you go on the walks, you'll undoubtedly come across springs. In this area, there are loads of springs all over. And they're coming out of the side of the hillside, and it's living water. It's moving all the time. He that believes on me, as the scripture will say, out of his belly will flow rivers of living water. But this he spoke of the Spirit, which they that believed on him should receive, for the Holy Spirit was not yet given, because Jesus was not yet glorified. So here is a physical thing, water, depicting something spiritual, teaching a spiritual lesson. And Christ was using a physical thing, which is water, to go ahead and just do that. Well, let's extend it a little bit more, because if you go over to James chapter 5, I'm not sure whether you've noticed this scripture in this light, but it's certainly, it is using the same kind of analogy, the analogy of water, the analogy of rain, the analogy of the Spirit. Because it's here in James chapter 5, verse 1, it says, go to now, you rich men, verse 1, weep and howl for your miseries that will come upon you. Your riches are cankered, are corrupted. Your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver is cankered, and the rest of them will be a witness against you. You'll eat your own flesh, as it were fire. You've heaped treasure together for the last day. In other words, their emphasis is all on the physical. The entire emphasis is on physical things. But it says, behold, and this is what God looks at. It wasn't just the physical things that he was looking at. He says, the hire of the laborers that have reaped your fields, which is you've kept back by fraud, cries. The cries of them that have reaped are entered into the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. Now, I've heard of cases where moneylenders will lend money in some third world countries to such an extent with such interest that the interest is then passed down into succeeding generations. And people are basically slaves. They cannot get out of it. There is no way they can get out of it. And it goes down into succeeding generations and is therefore applied with rigor against succeeding generations. But he says, you've lived in pleasure on the earth, you've been wanton, you have nourished your hearts as in the day of slaughter, you've condemned and killed the just, and he does not resist you. Be patient, therefore, brethren. So we see all this. We see this kind of thing going on. We can see the kind of atrocities that are happening. It says, you be patient as you see these things, when you see this problem in the earth. Be patient unto the coming of the Lord. Behold, in other words, look, notice, observe carefully. The husbandman, the farmer, somebody sowing his field or whatever, who waits for the precious fruit of the earth and has long patience for it. That's the way God is. He's got long patience. He's looking at the way the land is producing and how the fruit is coming. Until he receives the early and the latter rain. There's two rainfalls. There are two rainfalls in Palestine. You've got to have both. To have the full harvest, you've got to have both rainfalls. The rainfall is a symbol, as we've just seen about water, is a symbol of the Spirit. There are two outpourings of the Spirit on the world as a whole. We are in one of them, which is a very small harvest. But later, the latter harvest is the major rainfall, and the major harvest will result from that rainfall. It says, you be also patient. Establish your hearts. In other words, allow your hearts to just remain there. You're watching what's going on. Just understand that God is like a farmer. He's watching what's going on. He understands. But he's waiting. He's patient. For the coming of the Lord draws near. So, this again is likening that. Now, as far as the rain, the early and latter rain, I mean, over here, it rains 8 days out of seven. It just, you know, it virtually always rains. We don't have the early and latter rain. Now, I made the comment about Mrs. McKenzie this morning regarding the rain. I'm sure that somebody's been praying for fine weather because look at it now. It's absolutely wonderful at the moment. But I must point out that the reason why Mrs. McKenzie really likes the rain is because of the area that she lives in. I mean, there are only 8 weeks in which you basically get rain. If it rains any of the other times of year, any of the other weeks, if it even gets to the ground, if it doesn't evaporate before it hits the ground, when it hits the ground, it kind of stirs the dust. That's about as much as it does. And it evaporates almost straight away. It's that dry. It's such an arid area. I mean, what was the temperature? It's about 110, was it? It was 100 and something, anyway. It regularly goes up over 100. And those 8 weeks of rain are the only rain they see. So they come over here and say, whoa, this is absolute wonderful weather. It's cool. It's wet. You know. So everybody's got a different view of things. But here, we're looking how the physical teaches the spiritual. And we've seen how the water has a parallel. And here we see there are actually two seasons that God is patiently waiting for, like a farmer. Now we can see those two seasons. If we go back to Deuteronomy 16, Deuteronomy chapter 16, we find the two seasons, or the two harvests, actually being mentioned. Now, Deuteronomy 16:16 is what we read regarding an offering. Three times in a year shall all your maize appear before the Eternal, your God, in the place you shall choose. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, and the Feast of Tabernacles. So there's the three seasons, three times. But the first two are actually linked. If you notice in verse 9, it says, 7 weeks shall you number to you, begin to number the 7 weeks, from such time as you begin to put the sickle to the corn. Now, if you remember, in the middle of the Days of Unleavened Bread, on the Sunday during the Days of Unleavened Bread, that was the time they put the sickle to the corn. They made the wave offering, and we'll go back and read that. And that then is all linked up with the first early rain. And from that time all the way through to Pentecost was the first harvest. It was a smaller harvest. And then it says, verse 13, and you will observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days after that you have gathered in your corn and wine. So there's the second harvest from the second rain, from the second crop. Again, going over to California, you can see this a great deal more, although you're using irrigation over there in the San Joaquin Valley. Nevertheless, you can see the two harvests in the fig trees. Over there, all figs. I mean, over here we have, I don't know whether, did you actually get the early figs at all? There's nothing. I mean, it's growing figs over here is it's a dead loss. You don't get much in the way of figs. But over there, I mean, a fig tree can be half the size of this room quite easily. Huge, great fig tree. And the figs themselves, they're this kind of size, and they actually dry on the tree. And they're not dried figs like you buy in the shops over here. They're dry and they're sticky and they're sweet and they're as good as any Mars bar. They're wonderful things. But they have two crops. The first crop comes and then you can see the other crop forming in the back of them. And this first crop will be there and you pick the first crop, which is the best crop. It's the biggest things. And then the next one will come after that. And it's linked to the two rains as far as Palestine was concerned, if you're not irrigating the way they do in California. But if you turn over to Leviticus 23, you can see here, again, these two seasons being mentioned. And this first season, this first harvest, is tied in with this first rain, this first outpouring of the very Spirit of God. The symbolism is tied in there. And when we're looking at the Feast of Tabernacles, it is built around the Palestinian, or Palestine, the harvest within Palestine. So it's built around the harvest that you find down there. And Leviticus 23, in verse 14, it says, you will eat neither bread, nor parched corn, nor green ears, until the selfsame day that you brought an offering to your God. It'll be a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwellings. Now this is talking about the first of the first fruits. As it says in verse 10, it says a sheaf of the first fruits. It literally means the first of the first fruits. It's the first, it depicts Christ. It depicts the time that just after his resurrection, on that Sunday morning, when he was resurrected, he had to be offered to the Father and offered as the first of the first fruits. And that then began the first fruit harvest. It was from that point that they would then harvest the grain, and they would make that harvest from this early rain all the way through to Pentecost. That's verse 17. It says, you'll bring out of your habitations 2 wave loaves of 2/10 deals. There'll be a fine flour, and they will be baked with leaven. Now, all the other bread that you'll find is baked without leaven, but here you've got something actually baked with leaven. So here, again, we're looking at all tied in with that first harvest. Then in verse 39, it says also, in the 15th day of the 7th month, when you have gathered in the fruit of your land, you will keep a feast to the Eternal 7 days. On the first day will be a Sabbath, and on the 8th day a Sabbath. That's where we are right now. That's the latter harvest in that regard. So these two harvests, these two harvest seasons, are all tied in with the meaning of this day. Why we're here, why we're keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. It's to do with the latter harvest. It's to do with harvest. It's to do with the outpouring of rain, rain being a symbol of the very Spirit of God. The meaning of today, the meaning of this particular period of time that we're in, is all tied up in with the harvest season. Now, when you look at tabernacles, though, it's got to fit within a much bigger plan. Within Leviticus 23, notice what it says. It says, verse 2, it says, speak to the children of Israel and say to them concerning the feasts of the Eternal, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, that's gatherings. Even these are my feasts. So these are where the people of God gather together. These are the feasts of God. And it says, 6 days shall work be done, but on the 7th day is the Sabbath of rest, a holy convocation. So the first one is the Sabbath, and that occurs every single week. And the picture of the Sabbath every single week is 6 days. As we work through those 6 days, we're looking at 6,000 years. When we come to the rest on the Sabbath, on the Friday evening, as we approach the Sabbath, our mind should be thinking about what it means. It's not just the Sabbath memorial of creation. It's the fact that come Friday evening, which is where we are now as far as history is concerned, we're looking for the very time of God, that 1,000-year period to start. But then you're looking at the other days as well. In verse 7, the first day of unleavened bread, you'll have a holy convocation. Now notice that verse 5, it says, in the 14th day of the first month at even is the Eternal's Passover. That's not a convocation. It's not labeled as a convocation. So it's not a feast day. It's not kept as a feast day, but it has got to occur first. Without the Passover, without the sacrifice of Christ, the rest of the feast can't occur. But once that has happened, once that has occurred, and once without the Passover, they could never have got out of Egypt. They could never have kept any of these other days. They were still under the taskmaster. So you've got to have the Passover. The Passover is absolutely paramount. The sacrifice of Christ is absolutely paramount. But it's not a feast day. It begins the plan of God, but it isn't forming the plan of God. The plan of God is concerning what God is doing with humankind. So you're looking at the Passover has got to be there. You've got to have the shed blood. Without that, you can't have anything. But then this plan starts. And people end with Easter. I mean, that's the end of the story. It's only then that you can actually start the very plan that is depicted here. In verse 7, you've got the first holy day, which is the one, when you're looking at the first holy day as far as unleavened bread is concerned, and there will be no servile work done. That's the first convocation. Verse 8, it says, in the 7th day is a holy convocation, do no servile work. So you've got the two holy days there and unleavened bread. You've then got Pentecost, and between those is the day that the wave sheaf was offered. And then all the way through there until Pentecost is the time of the first harvest. And there you have that first harvest due to that first rain, those first three. You've then got this this crucial feast day or holy day in verse 24, which is the Day of Trumpets. Again, it mentions it's a holy convocation. And then you have Atonement, verse 27, and then the first Day of Tabernacles, verse 34-35. It says the 15th day of the 7th month will be a Feast of Tabernacles for 7 days. On the first day will be a holy convocation. And then verse 36, it says that on the 8th day, that's the day after Tabernacles, will also be the holy convocation. So you have three holy days, which is the 2 days of unleavened bread and Pentecost. You've got Atonement, the first Day of Tabernacles, which we're on now, and the last great day. And in the middle, you've got the Festival of Trumpets. The whole thing revolves around that Feast of Trumpets. The very holy days themselves, the calendar moves according to the Day of Trumpets. Wherever Christ will return, the whole plan of God will shift and move around accordingly. Now, nobody knows that day except the Father, but that is such a crucial time. Now, these days, and when I notice that as I start explaining and going through these days, and it behoves me, giving a meaning of the day, to go through the days and go back to Leviticus 23. And I've got to do that. But I've noticed that all the eyes kind of, particularly after a meal such as we have, all the eyes start to go heavy, and you see people kind of fighting, and the expressions of faces just keep changing, and they struggle, and they struggle away. But you know, can you imagine what I've just explained to you? What have I just explained? The plan of God. The meaning of life. The plan of God and the meaning of life. Where are you going to get that? Where on earth do you get some knowledge like that? You know, the world outside has no understanding of it at all. All of this creation, everything that we can see, out the windows or whatever, it's all for a purpose. And the holy days that I just got to explain, that we go through day in, every convocation, we go through these holy days, we explain what they mean. And if we turn over to Matthew chapter 11, it says here in Matthew chapter 11, and I understand, because when I'm sitting there and somebody else, Mr. Henderson or somebody is up here giving it, I'm struggling as well, trying to keep my eyes open. But Matthew chapter 11, in verse 20, it says, then he began to upbraid the cities when most of his mighty works were done, because they did not repent. He says, woe to you, Chorazin, woe to you, Bethsaida, for if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. But I say to you, it shall be more tolerable, so there's a range of tolerableness, if you like, for Tyre and Sidon in the day of judgment than for you. So you're looking at the day of judgment being the last great day. And you, Capernaum, which are exalted to heaven, will be brought down to hell, for the mighty works that have done in you had been done in Sodom, and it would have remained until this day. There is going to be some kind of I'm not going to say bloodletting, I'm going to say some kind of a balancing that must take place in the resurrection, because certain problems have occurred in the past, that really there's a balancing that almost certainly will come. But I say to you that it will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for you. And at that time, notice verse 25, so here we are, we're looking at the time into the future, looking right down as far as the plan of God is concerned. And at that time Jesus answered and said, I thank you, O Father, of Lord of heaven and earth, because you've hidden these things from the wise and the prudent, and you've revealed them to babes. Even so, Father, for so it seemed good in your sight. All things are delivered unto me of my Father, and no man knows the Son but the Father, neither knows any man the Father except the Son, and to whoever the Son will reveal him. These things that we understand were revealed they did not just come by accident. It's something that was revealed. Something that came at a particular time in history. And these holidays, really, I mean, we go through them, and you look at, as I say, just look around this room. Look outside the windows here, and just look at the creation. I mean, I can see out the back door now, and the creation. And you see the flowers, and you can go into the flowers, and you can see, if you look at something which is artificial, you start touching them, you're delving a little bit deeper, and you suddenly start realizing that they're only artificial. But you get something which is real, and you go further and further and further and further into it, and it becomes more and more profound as you go into it. This creation is awesome. It is awesome. I mean, there's no other word for it. The plan that is involved with this creation, the trouble that has been taken within this creation, it has got to be big. It has got to be huge. Whatever that plan could be, just looking at the physical creation, you've got to come to the conclusion that it is something which is absolutely huge. We turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 2. 1 Corinthians chapter 2. It says in verse 6, it says, "Howbeit we speak wisdom among those that are being made perfect, yet not the wisdom of this world." It's a different type of wisdom. Nor of the princes of this world, nor of the rulers of this world, that coming to nothing. All the rulers and all the high and the mighty within this world will not survive into the future in their position of rulership. All the positions of rulership will be annulled. But we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, even the hidden wisdom which God ordained before the world to our glory, which none of the princes or the leaders of this world knew, for had they known it, they wouldn't have crucified the Lord of glory. But as it is written, "Eye has not seen, nor ear heard, neither has entered into the heart of man, the things which God has prepared for those that love him, but God has revealed them." So if we understand it, if we can understand this particular plan, it's because these things were revealed. Now God tested the person before he revealed these things. He allowed him to be actually keeping these days without knowing what they meant for 7 years, just him and his wife. Just him and his wife. Then for another 7 years, with a small church group, and then they had to start keeping they suddenly realized they needed to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, and they began keeping the Feast of Tabernacles, not just the holy days, but the actual feast itself, and they went away for the feast for the first time. And then, a few years later, they began to understand why. As I understand it, that's the sequence of events that occurred. So God tested, he tried Mr. Armstrong. He wanted to see what kind of mind was there, whether in fact this man would be obedient. But once he was convinced that no, he was genuine, he would in fact follow him, he would in fact remain obedient, the greatest revelation that has ever been given. I mean, is there anything else? What else is there rather than the meaning of life? I cannot think of anything else greater than the revelation of what is within these days. It is the meaning of life and the plan of God. What else can be bigger than that? It is just a phenomenal revelation. It says, "But God has revealed them to us by his Spirit. For the Spirit searches all things, yes, the deep things of God. For what man knows the things of a man, except the spirit of the man that's in him?" So you can talk to a cow until you're blue in the face. You're not going to get through. The only way you get through is with a bucket of concentrate, with a... And what did you call it? It wasn't concentrate, was it? Grain, there you go. Okay. It means something different in the States. But what thing, except the spirit of man that's in him. Even so, the things of God knows no man but the spirit of God. If you're going to talk to a human being, you're talking, you know, the spirit of man is giving the understanding. You can talk to a cow and it will not understand. You've got to use a stick or something to bribe the cow. That's the only thing the cow is going to understand. but it says the spiritual things also, we are not going to understand unless that Spirit of God is there. Now, if we notice here, though, it says in verse 12, it says, we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit which is of God, that we may know the things that are freely given to us of God. These things have been freely given. Yeah, but we need to close it. You go ahead and close it a bit. That's it. If we notice in the preceding chapter, in verse 1, in chapter 1, verse 23, it says, because the foolishness of God is... verse 23. But we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block, and to the Greeks foolishness. But to those that are the called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God... In other words, you put Christ and what he did, Passover and everything else that he did, into the context of the plan of God, the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, the weakness of God is stronger than men, for you see your calling, brethren, how not many wise after the flesh, or many mighty or noble are called. And around this room, there are no noble, no mighty that I know of. Wise? Well, I'd hope some would be wise, but not after this world. You know, there's not, you don't find them after this world. And God has chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. He's chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things that are mighty. And base things of the world and things that are despised has God chosen. Yes, and things that are not, to bring to nothing the things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. So when we're looking at the feast, when we're looking at tabernacles, we're looking at it fitting within a plan that allows God to stop any kind of man glorying and saying, hey, look at me, aren't I wonderful? I mean, that simply is not going to work. That is not going to happen at all. And what in fact is going to happen as far as the world is concerned, when we look at the world itself, we see this as a church age. We see the return of Jesus Christ at a certain time in history and the binding of Satan. And at that time, when Christ actually will return, the world will have got to a certain stage. You're looking at a certain stage that the world has reached. Remember what it said when we read originally back in James? It says he's waiting. He's waiting for the first rain and the latter rain. And the first rain and the latter rain brings a certain harvest. I remember the context of what he was saying. He was saying the context in the area of people who were oppressing other people. People who are oppressing other people, causing problems within the world. And he says, look, just be patient. Just be patient, and these things will be taken care of. But they'll be taken care of in their due time. In their due time. And the point is that when we look at the millennium, when we look at the millennium, we're looking at the start of the millennium in total, utter, abject chaos. The destruction will be huge. Turn over to Isaiah chapter 6. Isaiah chapter 6. Because mankind has got to get to a certain stage. And remember, this particular day is the first day of tabernacles. It's the meaning of the day. We're looking at the start of the tabernacles. It's the start of the tabernacle season. It's the start of the millennial rule. We're looking at the beginning of the millennium, how the millennium will actually begin, how it will start, how it will actually kick off. And when we look here in Isaiah chapter 6, it says in verse 9, it says, and he said, go and tell this people, hear indeed, but understand not. See indeed, but don't perceive. Make the heart of this people fat. Make their ears heavy. Shut their eyes, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and convert and be healed. And he said, then said I, Lord, how long? How long is this state going to last? What's going to be the end of this time? He says, and he answered, until the cities are wasted without inhabitants, the houses without man, and the land is utterly desolate. It's got to reach a certain stage. until man, and they remain blinded, that you cannot start revealing the truth to mankind as a whole. You can't begin the latter rain of the Spirit of God so that people start to understand until a certain set time is reached. And God, as a farmer, is looking and he's waiting for that first rain. The ones that he's given, he's gone ahead and shown and revealed the plan to who? Not the wise, but the foolish. The ones who are weak in this world. He's deliberately chosen you and I. He's chosen us out of this earth to say, look, these people by themselves, nobody's going to look at them and say, hey, these people are really the brightest. These are the ones that are really the top dogs. No, they're not. They're anything but. But he's revealed things to us through the very Spirit, through this early rain, and at the same time, he's left the rest blinded. He's done it deliberately. Why? Because no flesh is going to glory in his presence. And what does flesh normally do? It's locked into Satan. It's locked into his wavelength. It's locked into his way of doing things. And he's going to make sure that no flesh, locked into Satan's wavelength, is going to glory. That cannot happen. So he's patient. He waits. He allows time to go on until finally, he says, eventually, the cities are going to be wasted without inhabitants, the houses without a man, and the land is going to be utterly desolate. And the Eternal has removed men far away, and there's a great forsaking in the midst of the land. But yet in it shall be a tenth. One in ten. Now we talked about the taking Israel into the wilderness and putting them under the rod, and it may well be that there's another tenth of the tenth in the future. But whether it's that way around or the other way around, it could be nine-tenths that go into the land. It's unsure, but if you compare it to what, in fact, the way the tithe was taken, it was just 10% of what's coming out of the tribulation. And it shall return and shall be eaten as a teal tree and as an oak that substance is in them. In other words, you chop down an oak, you chop down an ash tree. I mean, the ash coppices that you'll see around here, you chop down an ash tree and the shoots will come out the side. But, you know, you don't destroy the tree. The tree is still there. So you chop down the nation of Israel. The nation of Israel is destroyed. It's gone. But this tenth is going to remain, and it will then shoot. And it says, when they cast their leaves, so the holy seed is the substance thereof. That is the stock. That's the thing. And it seems to be that there are going to be certain people that he will use to start this this process. But these cities that are going to be wasted, it does mention, I'm not going to turn there, but Daniel 12:1 talks about it, Matthew 24:21 talks about it, and Jeremiah 30 verse 7 talks about it as a time so great that there's never been anything before and there'll never be anything like it again. There's only one time. There can only be one time. There can be no two times like that. Only one time is possible. Now, if we turn over to Revelation 18, some of the things that God is waiting for and Christ is waiting for is not just within Israel. Certainly Israel is part of the equation. But in Revelation 18, we find that not only is there going to be a tenth of Israel left, but the chances are that within the Babylonian areas, there is a hundredth that is left. Because you're looking here, Revelation 18, verse 6, it says, reward her even as she rewarded you, and double to her double. In other words, you're doubling what it is. Maybe that means 20th. Maybe it means 10 times 10. You know, again, it's unclear. But it could be as low as 1 in 100 that actually is left, or 1 in 20. It depends on how you look at it. But you're looking here, double to her double, according to the works. In the cup which she's filled, you fill to her double. So presumably it would be 1 in 20, or let's say you could double it in that sense of 1 in 100. And what's going to happen in the world as a whole at that time? Remember, this is the time when we're going to be the teachers, as we brought out this morning. When we look over in Revelation chapter 6, this is the world in which we're going to have to begin to teach. This is the world that starts the millennium. This is the contrast. And remember, as again was being brought out, and I've brought out before, if we look at the majority of people that have died, they'll have died in war. The majority will have died. Certainly, if these figures of, say, one in ten survive, or 1 in 20, or 1 in 100 survive, all those others, and we're looking about, 6 billion in the world at the moment, you're looking at a vast number of people who, in fact, will die within war, within pestilence, within dramatic ways. And even when you look at people who die naturally, there are very few of them that actually die in their beds as such. They're not only speak of my brother. My brother went through cancer. He died of cancer. He died of pancreatic cancer. I think of my father. He died of prostate cancer. And pneumonia, actually, finally, he died of. But the end, the few days before they died, it was not a pleasant experience. And then they die, and they have all that recollection, and then they come into the resurrection. And we're looking here, and we're looking at the things that actually happen here in Revelation 6, verse 12. One of the things that's going to happen is that they will have witnessed, perhaps many of these people might have witnessed, in verse 12. It says, "I behold, when he opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth." So here we're going into the heavenly signs. But at the time of the heavenly signs, when that occurs, and this is before the heavens roll back as a scroll, before the Son of Man returns, before Christ returns, you get this huge earthquake that is leveling areas all across the earth. The indication is that some kind of earthquake occurs. And you go again into Revelation 16. If you go to Revelation 16, notice the positioning of that earthquake is the time of the heavenly signs before the sign of the Son of Man. But here in Revelation 16, in verse 18, now this is the time when Christ has already returned, and here you have the actual plagues being poured out, and the plague of the seventh angel poured out his vial into the air, verse 17, and he says, it's done. So right at the very end, it says, verse 18, and there were voices, thunders, and lightning, and there was a great earthquake such as was not since men were on the earth, so mighty an earthquake, and so great. So here is another earthquake right at the very end, to such a degree that, as it says here, and the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. So that whatever was left of the nations, of the actual cities, all the cities that we've got now, have gone. And the earthquake is of such magnitude that it destroys the buildings. There's no building left. Even you look at the hurricanes. I mean, you remember the hurricanes? We're talking over lunch. You see the news. We saw them over here. We saw the hurricanes on the television that were going into Florida. We saw the satellite pictures. And the hurricane there was whirling its way around. What is it? Which way is it? Anticyclone? It's clockwise, isn't it, on a hurricane? And as it's going into Florida, you look down the bottom, and there's another one forming. And look a bit further over South America, and another one is forming. And they're all lining up, waiting to go into Florida. So when we're looking here, we're looking at the devastation that occurs because of the hurricane. And it's nothing compared to what's being mentioned here. So all the buildings, all the entire infrastructure is going to be flattened. And most people will have actually died within this chaotic world. This kind of chaos, they will have died. And those that have survived will then come through, and here we are, and they'll need to be taught. They'll need to be, they'll actually begin the millennium. It's a parallel. What's going on here within Babylon, within the world as a whole, is a parallel to when we look right at the very beginning of Genesis. You look at the beginning of Genesis, and it says the world was without form and void. It's a parallel because Satan was involved at that particular time, beginning the very world itself. It's the result of the same way. Again, he's waited until, he's patient, he's waited until that first rain, he's waited until the second rain, he's allowed the earth to produce what it needs to produce so that the man will be thoroughly sickened with what has actually occurred. The entire earth and all the people on it will be thoroughly sickened. Yes, there'll be some which will still be as rebellious as who knows what. They're going to be fighting against Christ, but within all this chaos. It just seems incredibly crazy. But you're coming from a crazy mind. It's coming from that kind of mind. And yet from that, so what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to paint, look, this is what people have died in. This is how people have died. They've seen all these kind of things. They've gone through all these experiences. And then they wake up at the end of the millennium. What kind of world are they going to wake up into? Do you see the contrast between the two? Can you see what God is doing? Can you see how he is allowing these things to occur? He's allowing as a farmer. He's waiting until the time comes right. We had melons growing in our greenhouse. And I watched those melons. I kept pushing my thumbs in, trying to... Because I don't know how long does it take for a melon to grow in California? So once you actually get a first melon, how long does it take until you get a full melon? About 2 months, is it? Okay, well, it took our entire season. I got about three off each plant that were growing in the greenhouse. But you had to wait. Because I did this last year. I cut one and it was as tough as old rope. I mean, your knife would barely go through the thing. But we waited. We waited until it was soft enough. And then it tasted better than a shop-bought melon. It was really good. It was really good. And so the first melons I've ever grown. I've never grown a melon before. We'll probably do some, if we're still here next year, we'll probably do some next year. But you had to wait. You had to wait until it was ready. And God is like a farmer. If you cut those melons 2 years early, you can't get anything for them. They're useless. If God goes ahead and steps in too soon, until man has completely and totally exhausted all his options, if he steps in too soon, he has wasted everything. All this work, all of these things that he's made, all of the beauty, all of the creation, the whole thing will be wasted to some degree. He's not about to waste it. He's going to wait until, like a farmer, until the time is right, until he has the world ripe for what he is about to show, for what he is about to illustrate. And he's going to illustrate the entire destruction of a way of life. It is the destruction of Satan's way of life, the way of grabbing, of getting, of acquiring for the self. And if you go ahead and you grab and everything for yourself, this is the end result of it, because here is a world that comes to a point at the end result of it. And then the people will die within this chaos and pain and everything else, and they'll come to the end of the millennium and they'll be resurrected into a world that has been prepared for them. That's the contrast. And when we look at the world that's going to be, looking as far as being prepared for them, we've just read about in Isaiah 51, it says about like Eden of God, this garden that God planted, the entire earth that starts to look as Eden did. The fruit is going to be tasty, to say the least. Nothing that we have in any way compares to the kind of fruit that we're looking at in Eden. It's not going to be produced by chemicals, pumped up, and made big, and then you get some of these huge apples and you bite into them and they're terrible. They're awful. It's going to have the flavor as well with it. It talks in Isaiah 35 verse 10 about everlasting joy being on their heads. It's a time of everlasting joy. But turn over to Deuteronomy 14 and let's have a look at the picture that God is trying to get across to us now here at the Feast of Tabernacles. What's he trying to teach us? Physically, what's he trying to get across? Deuteronomy 14, and it says in verse 22, you shall truly tithe the increase of your seed that the field brings forth, and you'll eat before the Eternal. And it says in verse 24, and if the way is too long for you, that you are not able to carry it, and if the airline will not allow you to take your cattle on board, it says, if the place is too far from you, which the Eternal your God shall choose to set his name there, when the Eternal your God has blessed you, then you will turn it into money. And it says, and you'll bind it up in your money in your hand, and you will go to the place that the Eternal your God shall choose, and you will bestow that money. This is the second tithe now. And second tithe is a blessing given from God, given to us so that we can understand this principle. And you shall bestow that money for whatever your soul lusts after, whatever you want, for beefsteak, or for mutton or lamb, or for wine, or for scotch, or for whatever your soul desires, and you will eat there before the Eternal your God, and you will rejoice, you and your household. So here we see a picture. It is something given to us, and we are commanded to rejoice. And we're commanded to rejoice in a physical way, as a picture of this world tomorrow. Because we're looking at a world that physically will have this kind of abundance. You know, turn over to Amos chapter 9, and we can see this physical abundance that's being prophesied for this particular time. And all of you down in Nigeria, I know when I was talking down in Nigeria last time, they said they appreciated me trying to translate the European Western concepts into an African context. Well, what I'm talking about as far as second tithe is I'm talking about gari, I'm talking about yam, I'm talking about fufu, I'm talking about papaya, and I'm talking about pineapples. And anything, those are that kind of thing, and I'm talking about chicken and rice or whatever else that your heart desires at that particular time. But here in Amos chapter 9, and it says in verse 13, it says, behold, the day is come, says the Eternal, that the plowman will overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes him that is sowing seed, and the mountains will drop sweet wine, and all the hills will melt. The picture is that the abundance of food, and that is, it almost is going to be plowed in. You know, today we have to go out and we've got to plow in the crops. Why? Because the rain comes down at the wrong time. It puts mildew on the crops. The crops start lodging. In other words, they go onto the ground and they start sprouting again. And you lost them. So what do? They have to plow it in. Or have to disc it, disc carrot. But this isn't the reason here. If anything, they have such an abundance of crops that they're able to go ahead and allow that to become the fertilizer if necessary. It's a case that one will overtake the other. And I will bring again the captivity, or bring back this captivity of my people of Israel, and they will build the waste cities and inhabit them. They will plant vineyards and drink the wine of it. They shall also make gardens and eat the fruit of them. So this time will be a time of gardens. It will be a land of unwalled villages. It will be abundance such as we have never seen before. It will be a family-based environment as well. We'll look at more of this as we go into the other sermons and sermonettes. And I will plant them upon their land, and they will no more be pulled up out of their land, which I have given them, says the Eternal, your God. But here we can see this abundance that is there. Even in addition, if you turn over to Isaiah chapter 11, not only will there be abundance, but the very character, the very spirit that we see within nature is going to change. It's not just that there's going to be tigers which will be tame. It is the very character and spirit that is there within nature. Now, how will the digestive systems change? I don't know, but whatever it will be, if God says the digestion changes, the digestion changes. He just has to give the word, and every single animal, every single tiger, will have a different digestive system. It's the same as in that computer there. If on that particular screen that you, sorry, all of those on the left-hand side, but and all of those in Nigeria, but on the left, on that screen there, you see all the windows that are available there. All those windows. There is one piece of code controlling all those windows within the operating system. And if that code was changed to say the windows are now round, it wouldn't be just a case that one window would change. All windows would change. Why? Because they're going to that particular piece of code to get the details of how to make a window. And when you look at a lion, when you look at a tiger, what you've got to do is change the spiritual, whatever the basis is spiritually that on which that tiger, that lion rests, whatever controls, it says, you know, that actually holds that lion there. You change that code, and every single tiger, every single lion will change. You change the DNA. We can see it in the DNA. And you just have to change a certain part of that DNA. Now, you'd have to do it for each one, because that's the physical way. But I'm saying there's something underneath. The Word of God is controlling something underneath, and He can change the lot. When His Word goes out, it will accomplish whatever He sends it to do. And here in Isaiah 11, it says, "And there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch will grow out of its roots. And the Spirit of the Eternal will rest upon him, a spirit of wisdom, understanding, counsel, and might, knowledge, and the fear of the Eternal. And to make him of a quick understanding in the fear of the Eternal, and will not judge after the sight of the eyes, or reprove after the hearing of the ears, but with righteousness will judge the poor, reprove with equity for the meek of the earth. And he'll smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he'll slay the wicked." That's how he actually fights. He will issue the command, and the very material that they are composed of will obey. In other words, it talks about the eyes will just consume in their sockets. They will literally disintegrate as they stand on their feet. Can he not also do the creation and make a tweak in the same way? Of course he can. Whatever he says is. "And then righteousness will be the girdle of his loins, and faithfulness the girdle of his reins. And here is the result. The wolf will dwell with the lamb, the leopard will lie down with the kid, the calf and the young lion and fatling will be together, and a little child will lead them. And the cow and the bear will feed, and the young ones will lie down, and the lion will eat straw like an ox." So the digestive systems have got to change. And what will he do? By the word that will come out of his lips. Something on those lines will occur. "And the suckling child will play on the hole of an asp. And the weaned child will put his hand on the cockatrice's den." I remember being in Ghana, and I remember walking along this path and being stopped just before, and this was a path going along. He said, "Look, just keep your eyes open, there's a cobra, somewhere in this particular area." And I didn't even know they had cobras in Ghana, but there's a cobra. He lives in a hole over on the left-hand side, so we walked very, very carefully for that little patch of land. And I remember again in Nigeria, in Lagos, we were having something at the Sheraton, and there was a swimming pool there, and there was a rubber tree there, and the rubber tree, we were looking at the pool, and this snake, and it just came out of the rubber tree, and it was 6-8 feet long, something like that, green one, tree snake, probably harmless. But I wasn't going to hang around to find out. And it came and it lowered itself onto one of the recliners, you know, where we'd just been, and kind of wandered around a bit, then went back up into the tree again and disappeared. And everybody came running out and tried to find it, and they couldn't find it. But you shouldn't have to worry there, because it says the suckling child will play on the hole of the asp, and the weaned child will put his hand on the cockatrice's den. "They will not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for," and this is the reason, "the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Eternal as the waters cover the sea." There are two ways. One's a way of give, and the other's a way of get. Have you heard that before? Two trees, two different ways, two different trees, two different directions in life, and these two ways are going to be contrasted. And here you're going to have people die. You know, this is the entire reason. Why is the millennium physically going to become a utopia? Why was it that the college was made the way it was? What was Mr. Armstrong's reason for doing that? He could have gone ahead and he rented a few rooms somewhere and just taught Bible classes. But he didn't. Why? Because he wanted to put something into the minds of the students. And he understood that we are physical. We understand things physically. You know, it means something to us to sit down with a beautiful meal, with a table properly prepared, with nice cutlery. It does something to us. We are physical. We like physical things. We appreciate physical things. We can understand the physical things. And these people that will die in abject circumstances, and the majority of mankind will, who then are resurrected at the end of the millennium and will see the result of 1,000 years of God's way, the contrast will be very, very apparent. I mean, very apparent is the understatement of the year. It will be phenomenally apparent. I mean, they will think they've died and gone to heaven. That's what they'll think. Undoubtedly, that's what they'll think. And in a sense, they will have died, and they will have come to paradise. You know, I tell you this day that you will be with me in paradise. They will be there in paradise, because that will be paradise on the earth. Physically, things that they can enjoy, presumably resurrected the same time as man was created, presumably around the Day of Trumpets, so that you have this abundance of tabernacles to teach them the things in tabernacles. That's the time. And the reason is the earth will be full of the knowledge of the eternal as the waters cover the sea. If we just turn just a couple of more passages in Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 40. Isaiah chapter 40. Now this one we did read last night, but I want to read on from about, say, where should we take it, about to verse 25. It says, "To whom shall you liken me, or will I be equal, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high and look. Who's created these things that brings out their host by number? He calls them all by names." And I went and gave an illustration of how many dots you'd have to have on how many pieces of paper, 300 feet high by 200 by 200 miles, with 8 dots to an inch in both directions, to just describe how many stars. He says, look, and he says, he calls each of them by name. "By the greatness of his might, for that he is strong in power and not one fails, why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, that my way is hidden from the eternal, and my judgment is passed over from my God?" How can a being that is controlling this, whose words and whose breath actually have made all this, how can this be? How can he possibly not see? "Haven't you known? Haven't you heard? The everlasting God, the eternal, the creator of the ends of the earth, does not faint, neither is weary. There's no searching of his understanding. And he gives," he reveals things, "and he gives power to the faint, and to them that have no might he increases strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men will utterly fall. But those that wait on the eternal, they wait until the early and the latter rain." They understand God's timetable. They understand the plan of God. "They will renew their strength. They will mount with wings as eagles. They will run and not be weary, and they will walk and they will not faint." We're looking into the very spirit being eventually. And it says, "Keep silence before me, O islands. Let the people renew their strength." Let them understand the things that are important so that they will in fact renew their strength. "Let them come near, then let them speak. Let them come near together in judgment." And over in verse 8, it says, "But you, Israel, are my servant, Jacob that I have chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend. You who I have taken from the ends of the earth and called from the chief men thereof and said to you, you are my servant and I have chosen you and will not cast you away. Do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God." Now it's looking at the beginning of the millennium again. You're looking at a time where, remember, there's only a tenth that survived. You're looking at a time where Israel will have been decimated, will have gone into captivity. It will be at its lowest ebb ever. And yet you look here, he says, "Don't be afraid, for I'm your God and I will strengthen you. Yes, I will help you. Yes, I will uphold you with the right hand of my righteousness. Look at all those that were incensed against you. They'll be ashamed and confounded. They'll be as nothing. And you, they that strive with you will perish. Double to her, double, as it says over in Revelation. You'll seek them, you're not going to find them. Even those that contend with you, they'll war against you, shall be as nothing as a thing of naught. For I, the Eternal, your God, will hold your right hand and say to you, do not fear, I will help you. Do not fear, you worm Jacob, and you men of Israel, I'll help you, says the Eternal, and your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. Behold," just notice, look, and I will make you a new sharp threshing instrument having teeth. You'll thresh the mountains and beat them small. You'll make the hills as chaff. You'll fan them and the wind will carry them away. All of the other governments of this earth will not stand before the kingdom of God. The kingdom of God will fill the entire earth. Read what it says in Daniel. They will not stand. And the whirlwind will scatter them, and you will rejoice in the eternal and will glory in the Holy One of Israel. And down in verse 19, we'll go on a little bit more. But it says, when the poor and the needy seek water, and there's none, and their tongue fails for thirst, I, the Eternal, will hear them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. The early and the latter rain. The early and the latter rain. The latter rain, that's the time of the latter rain. I will open rivers in high places and fountains in the midst of the valleys. And it's talking both physically and spiritually here. I will make the wilderness a pool of water, the dry land springs of water, and I will plant in the wilderness the cedar, the shittah, the acacia, I think it is, tree, and the myrtle, and the oil tree, and I will set the desert, the fir tree, and the pine. You don't get fir trees and pines in deserts. You just don't find them. You've got to have, you find them up the side of mountains and in more watered places, and the box tree together, that they may see and know. So these are physical things being done by God through his people Israel, that they may see and consider and know and understand together that the hand of the Eternal has done this, the Holy One of Israel has created it. That's the reason. So why the physical millennium? What's the purpose of it? So that they can see that contrast. Final scripture, Isaiah 32. Isaiah 32. And this is the reason for this day. This is the reason. This is the meaning of this day. The meaning of this convocation. The first day of the Feast of Tabernacles. The beginning. How this actually fits. And we'll read a reasonable portion of this also in Isaiah 32, verse 1. Behold, a king will reign in righteousness. Princes will rule in judgment. And if we are ready, then we will be reigning. And a man will be as a hiding place from the wind and a covert from the tempest. And today you cannot find that. That simply isn't the case. But it will be in the future. That will be the case. Children talks about going out into the woods. And it's something that is going to happen. As rivers of water in a dry place, as a shadow of a great rock in a weary land, and the eyes of those that see shall not be dim, and the ears of them that hear will listen. And the heart of the rash shall understand knowledge, and the tongue of the stammerer shall be ready to speak plainly. And at that time we'll understand this. It says that the vile person will not be called liberal. You won't have this double-speak political gobbledygook that you have today. Your vile person will not be called liberal, nor the curl said to be bountiful. For the vile person will speak villainy. In other words, if somebody speaks villainy, it's villainy. And we know and we plainly understand that. And his heart will work iniquity to practice hypocrisy and to utter error against the Eternal. And there's your standard. The standard will be there against the Eternal, against what the Eternal says. The word of the Eternal is the standard. And that gives the stability within the earth. To make empty the soul of the hungry, and he will cause the drink of the thirsty to fail. The instruments also of the curl are evil. He devises wicked devices to destroy the poor with lying words, even when the needy speaks right. But the truly liberal, and this is the way God will label things. The truly liberal devises liberal things. It is the way of give. The outgoing way. The truly liberal will devise liberal things, and by liberal things shall he stand. So rise up, you women that are at ease. Hear my voice, you careless daughters. Give ear to my speech. And there's so many churches today that have their words twisted. So you careless daughters, you women, these churches need to listen and pin their ears back. Many days and years shall you be troubled, you careless woman. For the vintage shall fail and the gathering shall not come. And there's a time of judgment that will come on these churches at that time. Tremble, you women that are at ease, you troubled, you careless ones. Strip and make you bare and gird sackcloth on your loins. They shall lament for the teats, for the pleasant vines and the fruitful vines. And upon the lands of my people shall come up thorns and briars, and all the houses of joy in the joyous cities, all these briars and the destruction. Because the palaces will be forsaken, the multitude of the cities will be left, the forts and the towers will be dens forever as a joy of wild asses, a pasture of flocks, until the Spirit is poured out, until the latter rain. There's the latter rain. That's what this day is about. It's about the latter rain. It's about the harvest time. Until the latter rain, the Spirit's poured out on us from on high, the wilderness shall be a fruitful field, and the fruitful field be counted for a forest. Then judgment shall dwell in the wilderness, and righteousness remain in the fruitful field. What we will see produced within the land is going to be righteous, is going to be good, it's going to be proper, it's going to be the way it should have been in the beginning. And the work of righteousness, when these people are resurrected and see it, the work of righteousness shall be peace. The effect of righteousness will be quietness and assurance forever. That's the reason we're here. It's the case of being able to see God's way and Satan's way and contrast the two, to be able to see the effect physically so that people can learn, because people are physical. And people can see these two physical ways of life. They see the results physically from two different life, you know, mental states of mind. And that effect physically is that we can learn the important things. Same with Mr. Armstrong and the college. Why have all this wonderful, you know, landscape and gardens and everything else? To change the mind. That's what it was for. I remember my uncle, who was, you know, when we go to down in Bristol, from home to Bristol, going there, I see about 5-6 of his lorries on the motorway virtually every time, and on the way back. He's got a depot down, or he hasn't, he's dead now, but he is, his family is quite wealthy, he's about the most wealthy of our family. But he came to college at our marriage, and he was absolutely bowled over. He lived in quite a high household in East Germany. He's German. And he was completely and totally overawed with college. That's what Mr. Armstrong wants to do. You see, you can't tell him about these things. You couldn't start preaching to him out of this book. But you create and you put the effect of righteousness into effect. And he walks into the college, and he opens his eyes, and he can see it. And people will be resurrected, and they will open their eyes, and they can see it. That's the reason. And that's the reason for the millennium. That's the purpose of the physical things, and why we will have these physical things in the millennium. It's the very purpose of, you know, human life. It's the purpose of human life, so we can see the difference between these two ways. It's why the feast, it's why the millennium, and it's why we are here.